Hello, I'm Peter Anthony Holder. You know, the guy who hosts this show. This is number 0400, the Stuff File program with, you know, the guy who hosts this show, Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0400. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Ron Kaplan, author of Hank Greenberg in 1938. He shares some of the anti-Semitism Hammer and Hank had to deal with in those days.
I always find it fascinating that he happened to ply his trade in what was probably the most anti-Semitic city in the United States at the time, Detroit. Detroit was the home of Henry Ford, who was a notorious anti-Semite, and then Father Charles Coughlin, who was the equivalent of a Rush Limbaugh or a Bill O'Reilly these days. So he was playing under some fairly tough conditions.
Hollywood props manager Don Nunley shares stories of working on Steve McQueen's racing film from his book, Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror.
It was an extremely interesting experience. It was a milestone for Steve McQueen, and for me, I was only 30 years old. It was an amazing challenge to have a film of that magnitude handed to me to be the prop master on. Most prop masters at that time were in their 60s, so I was kind of an anomaly, and they probably used that as a good thing, because I could work harder and probably dumber than the others, and I'd do a lot of things.
Susanna Jansen, author of Wordstruck, on saying hello and goodbye on the phone.
When we say hello on the telephone, it's only because Thomas Alva Edison insisted on hello after Alexander Graham Bell had invented the telephone. Alexander Graham Bell wanted it to be ahoy. The original telephone was completely open on both ends, and in order for the communication to be able to begin, one word had to be spoken clearly, but there were also other contenders like, what is wanted? Are you there? Are you ready to talk? But Alexander Graham Bell lost with his word ahoy, and Thomas Edison won out with his word hello.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0400 was me, Peter Anthony Holder, host of this little extravaganza. I did the guest slate on the very first show, and I also did the slate on the 100th, 200th, and 300th show. Have you noticed a pattern here? Yeah. Thank you very much, Peter Anthony Holder, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. I understand he's a very nice guy, if not somewhat pretentious. This is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff on this, our 400th edition of the Stuff File program. Police in California released photos of a woman who was found wandering on the streets naked. Fresno police asked the public to help in identifying the woman who was naked with just a sports bra on when she was found wandering a street in the early morning hours. The woman did not give police much information. She told police her name was Joanna and that she was a mermaid. Yes, you heard me right. I said mermaid. She told police that her hair was wet because she had been in a lake. She also answered, "I don't know," to most of their questions. The woman was taken to a hospital for observation. Police identified the woman as 5 feet and 4 inches tall, weighing at about 150 pounds with brown eyes and brown hair, and she has webbed toes on both feet. Yes, webbed toes on both feet. The woman, whose identity was not released, came to Fresno last week. She was visiting the area as she was contemplating moving there. From where? Atlantis? You know, I've seen her picture and just read the description of her to you, so we can rule out Daryl Hannah. I also have to mention that having web feet means that she can never wear what I like to consider the most annoyingly noisy piece of footwear known to man, flip-flops. That alone is a blessing. Anyway, the plane was very small, Milan shipper noticed, and so I figured, would that make it to Australia? But the Dutchman boarded the Air Canada aircraft in Toronto anyway. That was the scheduled transfer for his trip from Amsterdam to Sydney. He bought the ticket because it was nearly $300 less than competing offers, and when he looked at the map display on the little seat-back screen in front of him, he finally figured out why. He and his summer clothing were on their way to beautiful, snowy Sydney, Nova Scotia, right here in Canada. He cursed to himself, but the flight had already taken off. When he arrived in Sydney, airport employees helped him find his way back home. I'm assuming they sent him to Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and not to the Amsterdam in New York, the Amsterdam in Manitoba, or the Amsterdam in South Africa. Okay, once Amy Robertson passed her interviews and background checks to become the principal at Pittsburgh, Kansas High School, student reporters at the Booster Redo, that's the school's newspaper, started working on a story to introduce her to the 900 students there. Now, when they checked, they found that the school Robertson claimed to get her master's and doctorate degrees, which qualified her for the $93,000 per year job, wasn't really a real school, but a diploma mill that sells degrees. Now, worse, they found that the previous school she had run, a private English language school in Dubai, received an unsatisfactory rating from the Dubai Education Authority every year for 4 years until it was closed. If students could uncover all of this, said student reporter 17-year-old Maddie Baden, I want to know why the adults couldn't. Once their article was published, Robertson quickly resigned. Superintendent Destry Brown announced the school will reopen the job posting. Our goal is to find the best person to be our principal that we can find, he said. Well, then may I suggest you put 17-year-old Maddie Baden on the reviewing committee. That might be a good move. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, call me cold and callous, but there is one group of people I really don't feel sorry for, and this next person has just joined that group. A young woman suffered injuries and was rushed to a hospital after falling from a bridge while taking selfies, according to police in California. The Placer County Sheriff's Office said that the woman, who was not identified, and a group of her friends from the Sacramento area were walking on the girders underneath the Forest Hill Bridge. The woman took a selfie and fell from the girders, landing on the trail approximately 60 feet below. She was rushed to the Sutter Roseville Medical Center, where she is being treated for broken bones. She is expected to survive. Now, according to a spokesperson for the Placer County Sheriff's Office, the walkways under the Forest Hill Bridge are closed for the protection of our residents and our community. Any trespassers found on the bridge will be cited. Be safe and tour the bridge from the sidewalks above. This young lady is very lucky to be alive, and the consequences could have been far worse for her, her friends, and her family. So, do you think she has learned her lesson? Do you? Or do you suspect that her next selfie might be at the head of the pack during the running of the bulls in Pamplona, Spain? What say you? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We often hear of the plight of Jackie Robinson, the first baseball player to break the color barrier in the major leagues, and the subsequent racism and discrimination he faced in his career. There's another player who faced racial and also religious hardships long before Jackie. Back in 1938, life in the majors wasn't all sweetness and joy for Hammerin' Hank Greenberg. That's because he was Jewish. Ron Kaplan is the author of Hank Greenberg in 1938, Hatred and Home Runs in the Shadow of War. He joins us on the line right now from New Jersey. Hi, Ron.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. We don't spend a lot of time talking about this as we talk, as I mentioned, about Jackie Robinson, but it was a big deal, especially at the start of what was World War II, and we all know what that fight was over and who suffered the most in that. The fact that Hank Greenberg was dealing with anti-Semitism in the major leagues is something that the general population doesn't hear a lot about.
No, because, you know, Greenberg was white, so it was easy to overlook the religion at the time. I always find it fascinating that he happened to ply his trade in what was probably the most anti-Semitic city in the United States at the time, Detroit. Detroit was the home of Henry Ford, who was a notorious anti-Semite, and then Father Charles Coughlin, who was the equivalent of a Rush Limbaugh or a Bill O'Reilly these days. So he was playing under some fairly tough conditions, yeah.
Now, again, I bring up the analogy of Jackie Robinson. I know what his story, and I know how much Branch Rickey played a part in grooming Jackie to be in the league. Was there anybody on Hank's side, so to speak, within the inner workings of the Detroit Tigers to help make his transition to Major League Baseball smoother? Or was he just...
No, he had to do all that by himself. Again, I guess a lot of people didn't think about it in those religious terms in those days. It was only when he came up against, you know, somebody from the Deep South who heard stories about Jews but had never met one before. He heard comments, all kinds of comments that I don't think is appropriate for this program to repeat. But it was said that aside from Jackie Robinson, one of his teammates said Hank probably had the toughest time of any player in the major leagues.
What about his teammates?
Most of his teammates, look, when you are a good player and you're doing well, everybody's rooting for you. There was a situation where he was sitting in the locker room with a teammate who, again, he came from a little outside Atlanta, and the guy had me staring at him, and he says, Greenberg says, "What are you looking at?" He says, "Nothing. I just never saw a Jew before." And Greenberg says, "You see anything interesting?" And the guy said, "You know, I thought you people had horns." So it was that kind of mentality in those days, you know, a lot of ignorance running around. And he wasn't the first Jew to play. I mean, there had been Jews before, but he was the first Jewish superstar.
Yeah, we should mention he had quite the record. What, he had 40 home runs and 184 RBIs in one season alone, and he was, what, the 13th player to ever hit 40 home runs in a year?
I'm not sure of that number, but I know he still holds the third highest number of runs batted in. And he said he didn't really care about the home runs. It was his duty to drive in runs, so that's what moved him the most. And he was a two-time MVP. He's in the Hall of Fame. He was the first Jewish player to go into the Hall of Fame. Sandy Koufax was the second. So he is, just as Jackie Robinson was a light for his people, Hank Greenberg was a light for his.
Was there any pushback from fans, or, as you say, when the team traveled, I would assume there are people who would have hated him just because he was on an opposing team, but adding the fact that he was Jewish was just something to add to it. But what about the fans? How did the fans in Detroit, how did they appreciate or deal with Hank Greenberg?
Well, you're right. You know, when he's your guy, you know, and especially a good producer as Greenberg was, they were all for him, and it only increased as he moved along his career. And he was, as I say, he was a role model for his people, and he refused to play on Yom Kippur, which is the most important day in the Jewish calendar, when the Tigers were in a heated pennant race in 1934, and they wound up losing the pennant that year. But he found a whole lot of respect from people who realized what he gave up to follow the tenets of his people.
Now, as I mentioned, it's at the brink of World War II, and we all know the atrocities that took place during World War II and the blatant anti-Semitism that was rampant at the time. Did the war era shadow into this? I mean, I assume so, considering the subtitle of your book is Hatred and Home Runs in the Shadow of War.
Right. As I did my research, I started looking just at the sports pages, but as 1938 went on and more things were going on outside of baseball, remember this is the heart of the Depression also, I started looking at the front pages, and it was frightening to see the headlines got bigger and bigger as things were going on in Europe, as Germany was invading Austria and threatening other surrounding nations. And this was noticed back home, of course. One of the things that I didn't realize when I was working on the book was how much things are the same now in a certain way. The United States is developing a policy where they don't want to accept Syrian refugees. Well, in 1938, the United States didn't want to take Jewish refugees. And in 1938, there was a theory in the United States of America First. They didn't want to get involved in a war in Europe. And now we have the same kind of sentiment, America First.
I know from experience that when one is different and you want to break into something in the mainstream, that sometimes family and friends will try and talk you out of it because you might be some kind of a trailblazer. When Hank Greenberg wanted to go into baseball, was everyone in his family agreeing to this?
Oh, no, no. You know, his parents had come over from Romania in their late teenage, early 20s. And the father developed a good business, textile business, and he wanted, there were four children in the Greenberg family, and he, just like all parents do, they want their children to achieve. They want them to be better than they were. He wanted all his kids to go to school. One kid became a lawyer, another became a school teacher, and Greenberg used to joke that he was the bum of the lot because he went into baseball. But after he did go into the game, and he did become celebrated and famous, his parents got used to the idea. The other brother, there was one other brother who also attempted a career in professional baseball, but he didn't make it.
Now, you focus on, first of all, how many years did Hank Greenberg play?
He only played 13 years in total because of the war. He lost three full years and parts of two others to serving in World War II. He was one of the first players to enlist, part of the Greatest Generation, who saw what their duty was, and he wanted to do it, and he missed prime years, and there's a lot of speculation of what his records would have been had he not lost his years, just like with Ted Williams and a few other players. Ted Williams lost time to World War II and the Korean War, and there's always, you know, gee, what would his numbers have been like if he had been able to play out his full career?
You focus specifically on the year 1938, probably his best year. Why focus on the 1 year?
Well, that was the year that Babe Ruth in 1927 set a single-season home run record of 60. And as 1938 went on, Hank Greenberg was approaching that record. And it started off slowly, of course, but as he got into July and August and September, he was nearing the record, and that was one of the things. Again, this is the Depression, so you look for anything to distract, and this was becoming a major deal, and the fact that it was a Jewish player trying for the record made it even more fish-out-of-water type thing. And he took a lot of abuse. There was a lot of speculation that pitchers would not give him good pitches to hit because they didn't want a Jew breaking the record, but in his own memoir, he denied that. He just said that as the season wore on, he wore out. There is an incident between Robinson and Greenberg that's very interesting.
Really?
Yeah. In 1947 was Greenberg's last year, and it was obviously Robinson's first year. Greenberg was playing for the Pittsburgh Pirates. The Tigers didn't want to pay his high salary anymore, so they released him, and the Pirates picked him up. And he's playing first base one day, and then Robinson bunted the ball, and the pitcher made a bad throw that Greenberg had to stretch for. He was playing first base at that time. And Robinson collided with him. So, you know, any doings between, you know, the African American and white players, you know, was magnified greatly. And, you know, people like gasped and wondered what, you know, if there was going to be a fight. But instead of that, you know, Greenberg helps Robinson up. In a subsequent at bat, Greenberg and Robinson are together at first base again. And Greenberg says, you know, I hope you didn't get hurt on that. And he says, you know, you know, I know you're having a tough time of it, but, you know, stick to it. You're one of the good ones, and I know you'll succeed. And Robinson was extremely grateful for that and then talked Greenberg up a lot in the press afterwards.
It's a fascinating story about a fascinating time. The book is called Hank Greenberg in 1938, Hatred and Home Runs in the Shadow of War. Ron, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. Now, you also have a website. You also deal a lot with players who are or sports figures who are Jewish, correct?
Right. I actually have the one you're talking about is Kaplan's Corner. I created it when I was working at the New Jersey Jewish News several years ago. As the newspaper industry has shrunk and I lost that job, I still maintain that. And I try to keep up daily with what's going on with Jews in all sports, not just baseball, but major and minor sports as well.
And do you have another website that people can also find out more information on?
I do. I have an older website. It's called Ron Kaplan's BaseballBookshelf.com. And as the name implies, it's mostly a book about baseball literature, but also pop culture, collections, art, music, films. The slogan is, if it can fit on a bookshelf, it belongs in the category of the website.
Mm. Again, fascinating story about Hank Greenberg, the book Hank Greenberg in 1938, Hatred and Home Runs in the Shadow of War. Ron, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Ron Kaplan, author of Hank Greenberg in 1938, Hatred and Home Runs in the Shadow of War. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0400, and you'll find links to Ron's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's finger-licking good, if you're into that sort of thing.
And still to come on the program, we will talk about Steve McQueen's movie Le Mans. We'll hear from someone who actually worked as part of the crew on that film. Plus, we'll learn some interesting things about words that we say on the telephone from the author of Wordstruck. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more Stuff File news right here, right now on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And the Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, two convicted murderers imprisoned in Nepal married each other in February, though it will be at least 14 years before they can consummate. Now, 33-year-old Dilly Kurala, serving 20 years for killing his wife, and 30-year-old Mimkasha Bista, with another 4 years to go for killing her husband, will be allowed to meet, just to talk, twice a month until Kurala's term ends. A lawyer involved in the case said the marriage, though odd, was perhaps the last chance either would have to meet a suitable match. Well, you know, they had chances to find suitable matches in the past, and they kind of squandered them, didn't they? Yeah. And when I hear stories like this, or the fact that the Menendez brothers between them have had three marriages while being behind bars, I can only feel for those single folks out there who constantly lament, why can't I find someone? Clearly, the answer is you're looking in the wrong place and probably setting the bar way too high. Yeah. 60-year-old Carolyn Zarate Boyle, a U.S. Postal Service employee in Aurora, Colorado, has taken 112 sick days in less than 2 years. Cancer, she said, and produced a doctor's note backing up her diagnosis. But with so many sick days came a review by the USPS Office of Inspector General, which noticed something. The name of radiation oncologist Dr. Greg Dickerson on her note was spelled wrong. He took the note to a cancer center who said Boyle was not a patient there. Boyle now faces charges of passing forged writings, wire fraud, and possession of false papers to defraud the government. She faces up to 20 years in prison and a fine of up to $250,000. Yes, what a class act. You know, I wouldn't mind if the judge got a little creative with her sentence. I'd cut her jail time down to only 5 years, but I'd also require her to do the remaining 15 years as a full-time volunteer caring for cancer patients. That ought to do the trick. Sheriff's deputies were dispatched to a suspicious fire at a convenience store in Port St. Lucie, Florida. A suspect was still present. Upon seeing our deputies, St. Louis County Sheriff Ken Mascara said, the man put his hands behind his back and said, "Take me away." 64-year-old Richard Lloyd allegedly admitted he set the fire because he was mad at Arabs due to what they are doing in the Middle East, and was, quote, doing his part for America, unquote. He was charged with first-degree arson. By the way, the store's owners aren't Arab or Muslim. They are of East Indian descent. Well, America is safer now that Richard Lloyd is off the streets. Okay, we have a couple of stories that show some spectacular errors on the part of those involved. Number one, in March, jurors in Norfolk, Virginia, found 49-year-old Alan Cochran not guilty of attempted shoplifting, but he was nowhere to be seen when the verdict was announced, apparently predicting doom, since he had also been charged with fleeing court during a previous case. He once again skipped out. The jury then re-retired to the jury room, found him guilty on the earlier count, and sentenced him to a maximum 5-year prison term. Because of time already served, he could have walked away legally if he hadn't walked away illegally. Well, he'll have plenty of time to rethink his actions, won't he? Well, at least 5 years. And story number two, in March, a star soccer player from Ghana by the name of Mohamed Anis earned a Man of the Match award after his two goals led the Free State Stars to a 2-2 draw, but botched the acceptance speech by thanking both his wife and his girlfriend. Reportedly, Anas stumbled for a second until he could correct himself. "I'm so sorry," he attempted to clarify. "My wife, I love you so much from my heart." Yeah, well, you know, I've seen what that award looks like. All I can say is, that's gonna hurt when the wife inserts it. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, when 54-year-old Christopher DiOrio of Greenberg, Pennsylvania, was pulled over by police for a faulty brake light, he flashed his ID and badge showing he's a Secret Service agent. Sure enough, a check showed that there is a Secret Service agent named Christopher DiOrio, but the Christopher DiOrio who was pulled over wasn't him. DiOrio owns Doodle Scoopers, a company that cleans up dog poop. He pleaded guilty in federal court to fraud, telling the judge he bought the fake ID and badge online to impress women on dating websites. He married one of the women he met, but not surprisingly, that marriage is already having problems. "Your Honor," he summarized, "I'm not a bad man. I'm a dumb man." The judge went easy on him, 2 years of probation and a $500 fine. Interesting how a professional pooper scooper tried to shovel it towards women and the police. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Actor Steve McQueen had an amazing string of hit movies during his career, but he hit a career speed bump, literally, when he was making his pet project Le Mans in 1971. A new book chronicles that time. It's called Steve McQueen, Le Mans in the Rearview Mirror, and it's co-written by Don Nunley, who was the property master on that film. Don joins us on the line right now from Washington State. Hi, Don.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. First of all, so that people know what we're talking about, what exactly is a property master on a film? What's the job entail?
Well, I'm going to try to make it short and sweet. A prop master is basically in charge of everything in front of the camera that's used to make the film, other than the actors.
Gotcha. And this is something that your dad also did, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
That's correct. He was 44 years at Universal Studios, one studio career, which is pretty amazing. That doesn't happen anymore.
Yes, that is pretty amazing. So getting to the film Le Mans, first of all, you worked on this film as a property master. I mentioned in the introduction that it was a bit of a speed bump for Steve McQueen. It didn't really go the way he wanted it to. What made you, first of all, write this book so many years later?
Well, several reasons. One, it was an extremely interesting experience. It was a milestone for Steve McQueen. And for me, I was only 30 years old. It was an amazing challenge to have a film of that magnitude handed to me to be the prop master on. Most prop masters at that time were in their 60s, and so I was kind of an anomaly, and they probably used that as a good thing, because I could work harder and probably dumber than the others, and I'd do a lot of things.
So when this film was taking place, and this was Steve McQueen's racing movie, during the process, when did things, as far as you're concerned, start to go wrong? In other words, did this set become literally hell on wheels during the course of the picture, or was it something that gradually took place?
Well, Peter, the biggest problem on the film, and some problem on any film, we did not have a finished script. The studio picked up the picture when Warner Brothers put it in turnaround, meaning they no longer wanted to finance it. And the studio was Cinema Centers Films, a division of CBS. They thought they'd died and gone to heaven because they were handed a Steve McQueen movie at the top of his career, a racing film, and he was famous for Bullet already. They thought they had a no-brainer. The only problem is they never had a script. But they went ahead anyhow because Steve was kind of noted for going on without a finished script. John Sturges, who they chose to direct it, had directed Steve in The Great Escape and Magnificent Seven, so they felt they had the combination to go ahead and make the movie. We never got a script. We never got a finished script on the picture. So we were shooting by the seat of our pants. We were getting three or four versions of what we were going to do the next day, the night before we shot. We shot for 6 weeks without one word of recorded dialogue, without a leading lady. So it was definitely a formula for disaster from day one.
Well, wait a minute. You say you were shooting for 6 weeks without a single word of dialogue. What was it, just B-roll racing shots that you were doing, or what?
It was first unit, not B. It was going to be used in the film, and it was all racing stuff, which was magnificent, by the way. It's the reason the film is remembered today with such high regard. The stuff we shot, it was way before digital CGI images, and so everything in it is real. And it took a heck of a lot of planning and ingenuity to get the shots that we got. So the racing footage is extremely well done, and very proud of what we were able to do. The problem is it didn't have a coherent story. And they were shooting because they knew they were going to get a story sometime along the line. They needed all this racing footage. We were in France. The studio was getting nervous, of course, and somewhere down the line, Steve and John Sturges separated company, and Sturges left the picture. So we were sitting in France with a partially done film, without a script, without a director, and the studio obviously came over and took over the project, took it away from Steve, and we pieced together a film. And the film itself, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's something like 28 minutes or 32 minutes without a word of dialogue in the beginning of the movie. It's all narrative and racing footage. So you have to be pretty much a racing aficionado to accept the film on its basis of what it is. And like I say, it's kind of a classic today. People rate it in their top 10 of all-time racing films.
Well, you know, like you just mentioned, it is a classic today, but it was savaged by the critics at the time. You just mentioned the fact that it started off with a long period at the beginning of the film where there wasn't any dialogue. Would you say that it was a situation where it was a film ahead of its time, or just that people didn't get it?
Well, Steve had in mind to make a racing movie. He had just done On Any Given Sunday, which was a motorcycle documentary, which was extremely successful. He thought he could do the same thing with the 24 Hours of Le Mans, which is a fantastic race and a great background. But, you know, they had already made Grand Prix, which was a great success. It was a wonderful story, terrific racing footage. And we fell short. People expected more.
Now, in your estimation, I mean, you worked on the picture, but it's now revered certainly a lot more than when it was released way back when, in 1971. Do you feel it holds, it stands up, or is it remembered mostly because it was Steve McQueen's pet project?
I think if you look at it today and understand what you're going to see, it stands up. But if you expect a great drama, it doesn't. I'm very proud of what I did on it. I think the book describes all the problems we had along the way pretty well. It's not always flattering for Steve, but it's pretty down to earth. And I tried to remember things exactly as they were. And being there every day on the set certainly gave me a wonderful point of view. And the pictures I was able to shoot, my own 35mm pictures, cut 260 of them in the book, really turned out well. I'm very pleased with Dalton Watson Fine Books that published the book. They did a beautiful job.
Did you have any opportunity to talk to Steve McQueen after the film came out to find out how he felt about the final product and also how it was received?
I never saw Steve again. That's the way the movie business is. You make a film with somebody, you move on, you rarely work with them again. I just finished a film called Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman that Arthur Penn directed. I never saw Dustin personally again. So it's like that. Very few times. I worked with Jack Lemmon two or three times. I worked with Gene Wilder two or three times. But that was luck. And thank goodness it was. They were terrific people. Steve wasn't a bad guy. He just had a lot of pressure on him and a lot of problems, personal problems, not only the film problems. He was going through a divorce. He found out he was on Charlie Manson's hit list. It was a good time in Steve's life.
Did any of the personal project or personal problems that he was going through during the course of that film, did it ever manifest itself working with him, or did he keep that all to himself and remain very professional on the set?
I would say the latter. He probably was more professional. We all knew what was going on. He was going through a divorce. His wife was there. Neely, who he'd been married to for 15 years. We knew that he was using narcotics, but he didn't come on the set zone because he had to drive cars. And he drove the cars. He drove them over 200 miles an hour. He was a capable of race driver. But I think Steve, and if I describe Steve, he was a good old boy. If you liked to ride motorcycles and race cars, you were his kind of guy. He had a few hangers on her, but not as many as some actors. He brought his own people along. Every actor does. But they were all pretty professional. His makeup man, his wardrobe guy, all those people did the job. And I didn't see a lot of clickiness on the set.
When a film goes into the tank from a box office and from a critic point of view, sometimes it can have a negative effect on the future careers of those who have worked on that particular project. Was there any fallout for you or people you knew because you were part of that film, Le Mans?
No, I think people in the industry understood it wasn't. We did our job, but when they saw the film, I think they were pleased with the technical aspects. Camera work, the sound was terrific. I think my job was well covered. So it didn't affect us personally. It affects more the star, maybe the director. But Sturgis left, as I said. He just picked up and went home one day. And we brought in a by the name of Lee Katzen, and he finished the picture career because he was A-class director at the time. He was mostly a TV director, and he worked for years after that. The studio lost money at the beginning, but it recouped it eventually. It did okay in Europe, and it still sells today. So it did a fantastic, phenomenal box office success at the time.
But it is.
I made a lot of films for that.
Yeah, but it is still a great racing film, and this book would certainly be a great companion to those who have seen the film or are planning to still see the film. The book is called Steve McQueen, Le Mans, In the Rearview Mirror, and it has over 422 images, which I believe a lot of them you took, right?
That's correct. I carried a 35-millimeter camera on my neck the whole time, mainly because I had to match what was going on. You know, when you do a picture that takes place in 24 hours on the screen, and you shoot it over several months, and you're shooting different stages of the race, which hour of the race you're filming, it depends on how the cars look. We had to match the cars for the hour of the race each day we were shooting. And sometimes we were shooting hour one, sometimes we were shooting hour 23, and the cars looked totally different. So it's a huge job to try to match those nightly as we wrap for the next day, and we're never quite sure what we're shooting the next day. So it was a huge challenge for me.
And as you say, turns out to be a fascinating book as well. Steve McQueen, Le Mans, In the Rearview Mirror. Don, thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Well, Peter, thank you very much.
Don Nunley, co-author of Steve McQueen, Le Mans, In the Rearview Mirror. As we mentioned, Don is a second-generation film prop master. Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear more of Don talking about his amazing career as a Patreon reward. Just go to our Patreon page and become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram, and you'll hear some of the legendary stories about working on such films as E.T. the Extraterrestrial. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is around to hear it, does it still make a sound? People have been asking this question for generations, but in 21st century America, the answer depends on whether government regulations dictate behavior in the area where it fell. Let me explain. A few years ago, a tree that fell across a stream in New Jersey was flooding the area. It could have been easily removed with a tractor, but since the waterway was a Class C1 creek, regulated by the Department of Environmental Protection, a formal approval process had to be followed before the tree could be removed. The flooding continued, and local officials spent 12 days and $12,000 getting a permit to do what was obvious from the beginning: pull the tree out of the creek. Let's be fair, the biggest sound created by this fallen tree may have been the groans of taxpayers. When government regulations make solving simple problems like this such a burden, it's time for a change. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about words. Plus, we do have an idiot of the day, but I've got a few more Stuff File news stories I want to share with you right here, right now, on a program that is listener-supported and fan-funded. And it depends on you for our success. Join us here on the Stuff File program and join patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, a Chinese zoo is making some extra cash and promoting education by charging guests $145 for the privilege of cleaning up polar bear poop. The Wuhan Heichang Ocean Park in Hubei Province is offering a service once a week to adult guests interested in spending 3 hours experiencing the life of a polar bear keeper. The guests, who must undergo health checks and attend a short training session prior to their shifts, are given the opportunity to prepare food and feed the bears. But their main duties involve cleaning up the bears' duties. If you know what I mean. It really costs money to smell poop, but it's quite funny, 26-year-old Li Fengfan, a zoo guest who recently took the polar bear experience, told China News Service. It's hard to see polar bears, not to mention come into close contact with them. Park spokesperson Chen Ting said the goal of the program is education. It's the first time the park has had a program targeting adults, Chen said. It is a pilot to popularize science and knowledge of the animal for the public good, not for money. We actually don't want too many participants, as that would disturb them. Not to make money, huh? Again, may I remind you that they are charging $145 for you to clean up polar poo. In China, they sure know how to have fun, don't they? Would this be something you'd want to do on date night? Just asking. And speaking of date night at the zoo, the Appenhuel Primate Park in Apeldoorn, Netherlands, is engaged in a 4-year experiment offering female orangutans an iPad loaded with photos of male orangutans now housed at zoos around the world, with the females able to express interest or disinterest, similar to swiping right or left on the human dating app Tinder. Now, researchers admit results have been mixed, that some males have to be returned home, and once, a female handed the iPad with a potential suitor showing merely crushed the tablet. You see, part of the problem is that apps are not quite to the point of offering animals the ability to digitally smell each other. Come to think of it, that might be the problem with human dating apps as well. By the way, giving apes an iPad, is that the next market Apple is looking at? Yes. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Usually when you answer the telephone, you start by saying hello, and we usually say goodbye at the end of a call. But why do we do this? Word lover Susanna Jansen, a newspaper columnist and former college professor, has thought about this and has the answers. She's the author of Wordstruck, The Fun and Fascination of Language. Susanna joins us on the line from California. Hi, Susanna.
Hi there, Peter. Nice to talk with you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So you obviously are a wordsmith. You're into words. First of all, how did the idea of this book come about before we get to the hello and goodbye of telephone conversations?
Well, the book is an outgrowth of my newspaper column because I was writing every 2 weeks on any topic of my choosing having to do with words, language, and culture, the three big loves of my life. And so finally, I decided I would, you know, rewrite, add more pieces, pull it all together, and publish it in a book form. And that's what I've done. It's all on words, language, and culture, but it's on 55 different topics. You turn the page and you're in a whole new world.
Excellent, excellent. So again, getting back to the topic at hand, hello and goodbye when we answer the phone. Now, I know a little bit about the goodbye part and why we don't say what Alexander Graham Bell wanted to say, because I grew up here in Canada, Canadian kid. Alexander Graham Bell was a god to us, so we all learned that in school. But for those who don't know, share with us hello and goodbye when we talk about phone calls.
Well, we'll start with goodbye because you're mentioning Alexander Graham Bell. And, let's start with hello. That would be probably more appropriate. When we say hello on the telephone, it's only because Thomas Alva Edison insisted on hello after Alexander Graham Bell had invented the telephone. Alexander Graham Bell wanted it to be ahoy. And is that popular in Canada?
Well, at least Alexander Graham Bell and anybody who were seafaring, yes.
Well, he insisted on using it for the rest of his life, but the original telephone was completely open on both ends, and in order for the communication to be able to begin, one word had to be spoken clearly, and as Thomas Edison said, cheerfully. And his entry for that word was hello, but there were also other contenders like what is wanted, are you there, are you ready to talk, but Alexander Graham Bell lost with his word ahoy, and Thomas Edison won out with his word hello. But interestingly, you know, Peter, it also changed the social habits of the time, 19th century, because until then, one had to be introduced before one could speak to a stranger. They had to be introduced to the stranger. And with the, with the new popularity of the word hello, now people could just greet each other on the street. And it did change our whole social way of relating to people.
Sort of like the early version of what's happening now with online vernacular working its way into our daily living kind of thing.
Yeah, I'd say it is similar to that. Mm-hmm. Okay. And some variation of hello is used in around 40 languages all throughout the world, and really diverse languages, Arabic, Polish, Vietnamese, Hungarian. Some variation of hello may sound more like alo, but it comes from, and the Spanish hola also comes from that same lineage.
So what about the other side? What about the goodbye part?
Well, goodbye is such a sweet thing, because the original phrase was God be with you, God be with ye. And it was just this old way of wishing someone well as you took your leave. And in the 15th century, people still said every syllable of that phrase. But a century later, in the 16th, it had been contracted to something that sounded like gabouye, which is sort of a jumble. Everybody was already saying good day and good evening, so it was kind of inevitable that, you know, this God be with ye, would become secularized to goodbye, following that pattern of good day and good evening. But losing God to goodbye didn't sit well with a lot of people, and they kind of viewed it as a, you know, a degenerate utterance, trendy at best, that was just popular among certain slices of society. But you know how it is with, you were just mentioning about the phrases that we pick up through technology, phrases and words. You know, today's scandal or today's utterance goes viral and becomes just the reality, that the status quo that we accept very shortly. So that's how it happened with goodbye.
The English language is such a living, breathing thing, yet I find that there are several groups of people who won't allow it to live and breathe. In other words, they hate to see the changes to it.
Mm-hmm. That's true, but you know, if those changes didn't occur just naturally and organically as part of language, we wouldn't have an English language, we wouldn't have a Spanish language, we wouldn't have any of our modern languages today. You know, all the Romance languages, Spanish, French, Italian, Portuguese, etc., those are all outgrowths of Latin, as Latin was carried across the European continent, and those developed from the degeneration of Latin. And what we're seeing today, I wouldn't call it the degeneration of English, but, you know, English is a worldwide language, and there are more second language speakers of English now than there are first language speakers of English. And so our language is changing just at the fastest rate ever in its history.
I was about to say, isn't the English language one of the biggest scavengers of phrases and words from other languages than any other?
It truly is, because, and especially in this day, we're so globalized and we're all plugged in and we're listening to things worldwide, we're picking up words constantly, and you see this because they start showing up in the dictionaries. And one of the most frustratingly revolutionary dictionaries is the Scrabble Dictionary, the Merriam-Webster Scrabble Dictionary. And there are words in there, you know, technically you can't use words in a Scrabble game that are from other languages, but that dictionary is full of foreign words that can now be used in the Scrabble game. Everything from, like the Japanese word ponzu sauce, P-O-N-Z-U. Well, this is a fairly common word now in our language that came in through cuisine. Words come in through cuisine, they come in through technology, they come in through all kinds of avenues into English.
Well, you just used one, the word itself, cuisine.
Yes, French. Very good.
So yeah, and there are a lot of them. Rendezvous comes to mind. The list goes, when somebody sneezes, we say Gesundheit.
Yeah, which just shows we are already bilingual, well, actually multilingual, in many, many languages with words that are not part of our original English vocabulary, but we've used them so many times, we own them. And that's the whole process of becoming bilingual in a foreign language as well.
The book is called Wordstruck, The Fun and Fascination of Language. Are you still doing your newspaper column?
I am. Every 2 weeks.
And people can also find out more information. I noticed you've got a blog. People can go to your website, SusannaJansen.com, and Jansen is J-A-N-S-S-E-N, correct?
Yes, that's right. And Susanna is with two N's.
With two N's. And people could also go to your blog, too, and they'll find a lot of fascinating stories about words. And I think we should all find words fascinating, because that's our form of communication, literally. So.
Yes, it is. And they're endlessly fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Susanna, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It was a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Peter. A pleasure for me, too.
Susanna Jansen, author of Wordstruck, The Fun and Fascination of Language. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is number 0400, and you'll find links to Susanna's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. And by the way, those of you listening to this show in Nashville on GDPR Revolution 99, if you're really into words, then you have to stick around for the show that follows us. Away with Words with Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett. It's heard Monday and Sunday at 5 p.m. Central. Check that out. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Thieves once again attempted a fruitless smash and grab at an ATM at Mike and Reggie's Beverages in Maple Heights, Ohio in March, despite the owner having left the ATM's door wide open with a sign reading, ATM emptied nightly. I keep saying to criminals, attention to detail, attention to detail. Because why? Oh, why would they keep trying to rob a clearly empty ATM machine that is marked as such? One reason, and one reason only, they're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0400. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0400. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on Patreon, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Well, you weren't literally with him. Well, maybe you were, but I don't see how. I mean, he does record these in advance, you know, and okay, maybe you did listen with him. Who am I to call you a liar? And personally, I've never met the guy, and I'm not in a hurry to either.